Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Best Interest of the Family Radio. I'm Dave Taylor, always pleased to be joined by my co-host, Larry Heron, the parent coach. Good evening, Larry.
Hey, Dave. How are you, sir?
Terrific. So, what do you guys got planned for Thanksgiving?
Oh, my gosh. That's coming up, isn't it? Well, you know, we'll get that turkey and dressing and pumpkin pie. And actually, I think it's apple this year.
Ooh.
And plenty of cranberry sauce. And, Dave, cranberry sauce is like the Jerry Lewis of food, isn't it? I don't know. Does it ever come out aside from Thanksgiving, maybe Christmas?
Yeah. Well, I know that my sainted mother down in Indiana always makes up a batch of that. Sometimes, you know, the stuff with the oranges in it, too. I got to keep everybody happy.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
And speaking of my mother, she sent me a happy Thanksgiving from Indiana, and I'd like to share it with all the listeners. Maybe they'll find this really useful when they prepare their, you know, their Thanksgiving dinner. But she writes here, says, with Thanksgiving coming up, I thought I'd try something new. So I went turkey hunting and shot my first one. Can you believe that?
Wow.
My mom went out turkey hunting. You know, you never know what you're going to get from Indiana, you know, especially from, folks like me. And you've met my mom, you know, she's a real go-getter. Well,
I wouldn't put it past her for a minute. No way.
I shot my first one, scared the heck out of everyone in the frozen foods department. Now that's some good old Indiana humor for you right there, buddy.
that's the way them Indianers they go get their turkeys. I'm telling you, they
the old fashioned way
about it. Absolutely.
The old fashioned way. Just go grab it out of the freezer in the frozen food department.
That's pretty darn good.
But I'll tell you what, she's, you know, not only good at picking those turkeys, she's also good at sticking them in the oven and, you know, making them pretty pretty delicious when they come back out.
Yeah, absolutely. So, that's the best part. And, Dave,
yeah,
we have
what,
plenty
Dave,
to
yeah.
Plenty to be thankful for this holiday season. You know, you can count your challenges or you can count your blessings. And, you know, as we look back and consider the year and consider the future, I think we got plenty to count.
Well, and I'm real thankful for the fact that we, you know, you and I are able to come on a very consistent basis. And of course, consistency is also part of what we're going to be talking about tonight, having a consistent relationship, ongoing, regular contact time with your children. You know, consistency is important.
Yep.
I'm very grateful for our continued existence on Best Interest of the Family Radio, for my good buddy Larry Heron, who's always there, helping out folks with mental health professional questions, the fact that you and your family invited me over for Thanksgiving, because like a number of parents out there, I won't be spending that time with Rebecca, so I'm grateful to have friends and that I can spend that time with, and of course I'll be missing her, but you know that's just kind of part of being divorced or being in a situation like this where sometimes our kids are with us and sometimes they're not. I'm just grateful for the time that I have been able to establish with Rebecca, and I want to throw some blessings out there to folks that may be in the same shoes as myself, and I certainly hope that that time is not too far between. Because unfortunately, Larry, as you know, we do have a number of folks that listen to this program that have not had substantial time with their children or their children with them in quite some time. And we want to encourage all the listeners out there that that may be in that situation where perhaps you're struggling and fighting for substantial time with your children. Don't give up, because there are those of us out here that care enough to know that that your child needs you, and that relationship is important moving forward. Because it's important that that child know that it has two parents.
Absolutely, and you know, Dave, you hit it on the head when you talk about words like consistency. Consistency is everything, and obviously, when you don't have the time, it's hard to be consistent. But every day we wake up. Every day we wake up, every minute of the day, we can choose what kind of legacy we want to leave. And
True.
You know, just being what your children need you to be, regardless of whether it's an everyday experience or whether there's hours and months and years between the time that they see you. Being the man or the woman that they need you to be is going to bode well later on down the line. I know it's hard sometimes to believe that, to see it, to experience it right now, but in the future, it comes back. And the seeds you planted now and that you continue to harvest, if you will, it'll mean everything in the future. So if we speak in metaphors in that way, I mean, for example, just practicing every day, being a man or a woman of integrity and being the kind of parent that your children can love and understand and can come to. Just continuing to keep that access as open as you possibly can to them. They will gravitate back. You know, part of that is because kids have a need to know. Kids get curious. Kids want to know, you know, what about my heritage? What about where I come from? What about this medical issue? What about the way I look? What about this particular gesture or idiosyncrasy that I just can't explain? Well, yeah, you know, that comes from dad or that comes from mom and grandmom and dad or great-grandma, great-granddad. DJ at 7 years old, he's learning about what a great-grandparent was. He wasn't quite sure about that. He understands grandparent pretty good.
Sure.
But he's learning that my grandparents is his great-grandparents and that I was born on my great-grandfather's birthday, and that was his great-great-grandfather. And, boy, you should see the wheels turn. His eyes light up like a pinball machine. And, Dad, so you had a great-grandfather? And I'm like, yeah. And so did you. And great-great means my great. And, you know, he's doing the math. And it's just hilarious to watch, but it's also important because the older they get, the more they want to know. And who better to come to than their parents? And for that matter, their grandparents as well. That's great to watch, too. And that's what we bring them when both parents remain active and consistent in their lives. But even when things have happened that you can't be so active and consistent, you need to stand by. You need to be ready. You need to stand firm in your convictions and in your ability to be what your children need you to be, even in absence, because the day will come, and you need to be ready. You need to be prepared when it does.
Well, I'll tell you what, Larry. What's interesting about what you were discussing, for example, have you ever seen a mustard seed? You know how big mustard seed is.
Yep.
If you hold one between your finger and your thumb, you would barely be able to see it. But and I want to compare our relationship with our kids. And you talk about increments of time or consistency of time, even if it takes months or even years between those times, make it you know, significant time with your kids, make it count.
Yep.
And hand down those traditions and legacies that are important, you know, to you so that your child understands that's part of them. Well, compare it to a mustard seed. You know, it's such a small thing, but it grows one of the largest trees in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so don't, folks, what my point is that don't ever, you know, consider your time, no matter how big or how small, with your child to be insignificant. Because you could be in those small increments of time, you could be making a great influence on your children, especially when your children know that they might be missing you for a couple of weeks or a month or a few months. You know, they're going to value that time even that much more.
No question about it. They you definitely do. You definitely, just like that mustard seed, we can't see it. It's difficult for us, but the roots and the legacies that we leave are just immeasurable, and they go on. And that's why we've got to be what they need us to be.
Well, and talking about legacies that go on, we just met our guest, a couple of weeks ago at a Dads and Moms of Michigan, special monthly meeting. And that was a significant meeting because our guest tonight, Attorney Ivy Sheldon, was at that meeting, and Ivy is is part of the founding individuals that started what was then Dads of Michigan, which has developed into Dads and Moms of Michigan.
Absolutely. Yep, Ivy is a historical shared parenting advocate warrior, if you will, quite frankly. I'd never had the pleasure to meet Ivy before, but I'd sure heard his name over the years, and he comes with a great deal of legacy, and it's our pleasure, our honor to have him on tonight. He's a wealth of knowledge in family law and in advocacy work, and he's going to bring just a great deal of skill and knowledge to the table that I'm sure, quite confident, that our listeners are going to be able to use in a very constructive and effective way.
Yeah, and in fact, Ivy prides himself on the fact that, you know, we're going to be able to bring forth some things tonight about, shared custody and some of the laws that surround that, so that folks can actually go into their own cases and, in some cases, even instruct their own attorneys as to where, some of these golden nuggets are.
Absolutely. And, Dave, I've learned that is so, so important. If you don't know what things are supposed to look like, it's hard for you to know whether you're going in the right direction or not. If you don't understand what your rights are and you're just kind of dependent on, for example, an attorney to, you don't know if you're being steered in the wrong direction. It's important to understand what you're fighting for and why and what's on your side and what you're up against. And while you hire somebody to do that for you, you don't want to be totally dependent. I'd kind of like to see what's going on. I'd kind of like to see what's coming so that I can understand if the guy or woman that I've hired is navigating the right way. Not professing to be the expert in something, but at the same time, I want to make sure they are. I want to make sure I'm not getting thrown under the bus. I want to make sure that I'm not just totally dependent and out there on somebody who maybe isn't as good as they proclaim to be. And I think that's what Ivy's going to help educate us on, as to, in terms of how that relates to family law, that in fact we do have rights, we do have legislation and case law that speaks to those rights. And not every attorney understands it just because they're advertised to. It's important that we understand that it's there, and that we get somebody who knows how to advocate for it. So yeah, I'm excited, and very, very pleased to and appreciative of Ivy Shelton to come on tonight.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, something that you brought up that makes perfect sense. Let's face it, you need a good attorney. You need good representation like Ivy Shelton. But at the same time, laws are not just for lawyers. People like you and I, you're a mental health professional. I'm a general contractor. But, we're in these legal battles, and you have to understand, and you can go to, Michigan law, you can go to MCL, whatever it may be for, whether it's the Child Custody Act or whether it's, a Friend of the Court Act or whatever it might be. And it's in pretty simple terms. And if you have a question, of course, then you can go to your legal counsel and you say, what does this mean? How does this interpret?
Right.
But certainly most of us can read the law and at least glean something from it that we can take away. And like tonight with Ivy Shelton here, he's going to tell us where to look and in a number of instances how to interpret or how to understand what that law says. And with that said, I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome Ivy Shelton to our show tonight. Good evening, Ivy.
Good evening, guys. How are you?
Terrific.
Hey, Ivy.
Great. This should be a fun educational discussion we have over the next 45 minutes. I don't know how long you guys are on.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, that's about the right amount of time, but, you can have as much time as you need to go over these subjects tonight. And then the great part about producing this program is I have the on button and the off button, Ivy. So I'll tell you what, we'd like to start in, we gave a little bit of history about you, but I doubt we can speak to it to the effect that you can. So if you wouldn't mind, give us a little bit of why is it that you do practice family law, and what's some of your history and some of your experiences with Dads and Moms of Michigan?
Well, my history with Dads of Michigan is a result of my association with a gentleman named Murray Davis. Murray Davis is the founder of Dads of Michigan, and I was representing him some 20 years ago on a business contract law issue with one of his primary contractors. He was a subcontractor, and that case went into arbitration. We had a successful arbitration, and he received some significant monies from that ruling, and he took the bulk of those dollars and started this nonprofit company called Dads of Michigan. And when he started Dads of Michigan, he petitioned me to associate myself with the project, and I made it clear to him, no, no, 1,000 times no, because I, you know, family law is a very time-intensive, labor-exhaustive area of the law. Requires a lot of energy, a lot of emotions are involved, and I had a reasonably successful business practice, and I wanted to continue my business practice. However, if you've ever met Murray, I can say he's a very persuasive guy. I mean, he's very—he's a class guy. He's—I mean, I really care for this guy, and I care for his passion for what he wanted to do. So he persuaded me to involve myself with it in terms of providing men who came to his meetings just information on the legal system and how they could protect themselves and perhaps even direct their attorneys if they felt their attorneys were not knowledgeable to provide them the support they needed during their contested hearings. Now, there's something I want to initially make it clear to your listeners, because, you know, many of those of you who have attorneys automatically assume that that attorney is competent to represent you, and that's not the reality. The reality of the situation is that most of the attorneys who are representing many of the their clients don't have a background in family law. For example, family law is not a required course in law school, meaning you can go through that 3 years of law school, graduate from law school, pass the bar, immediately hang out a shingo, and begin practicing a divorce law or family law without ever having acquired one morsel of legal knowledge on the laws, Michigan laws relative to divorce or custody or any area of family law whatsoever. And unfortunately, too many attorneys who are practicing family law don't really have a clue about what they're doing. Consequently, the men whom they're representing typically get a bad deal. It's a tragedy, but it's a reality. And so consequently, your listeners need to know that many of the attorneys who are practicing in this field probably did not have one course in law school prior to passing the bar and practicing law. So you got to keep that in mind. I think once you keep that fact in mind, you're then kind of armed to initiate your hunt for a practitioner, because you know that there's going to be a lot of questions you're going to be asking, and you're going to be looking for them to have good legal answers. If they don't have good legal answers, they should run. They shouldn't walk. They should run from that practitioner. because he's not going to be of any real assistance to them in the courtroom other than an advocate. And being an advocate is not enough to help men and women get the kind of equity that they're deserving of in these courts.
So true, Ivy. And so what you're speaking of is they better have a knowledge base for all the case law, for all the laws that the judges don't always respect, and or even if they did, that has to be mentioned and fought for in a court of law for a judge to award. And it sounds like what you're saying is it isn't always on the judge, and it isn't always on recommendations as much as it's on an attorney who understands the law and how to prepare a case and how to fight for what that equity is, how to go about getting it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not going to play games about the obvious. Many of these judges are biased when it comes to especially custody disputes between dads and moms. However, I can also tell you that many of these judges are not biased and still tend to give mom a significant edge on these kind of disputes. And the reason is because the dad's attorney has not provided them good legal grounds to rule otherwise. I don't know about the last time you guys were in a courtroom where you had a male and female challenging or contesting custody. I can tell you the last time I was there, I was very much disappointed. The father's attorney was basically implying that the mother was some low-life, disgusting person. The mother's attorney was implying that the father was some kind of low-life, disgusting person. No real facts, just a very negative, nasty, format of put-downs. The poor judge sitting in the middle is scratching his head, not knowing what really to believe, and he makes the most logical, safest decision, which is I'm going to follow the custom of giving mom custody and dad can pay support and he can come see him every other weekend, because I really don't want to try to figure out which one of these guys are not so cool based upon the animosity that I'm hearing here. That's not good. What should be happening is the attorneys should not be playing the role of disgruntled wife or disgruntled husband. They should be playing the roles of seasoned expert advocates, proving certain facts and correlating those facts with the law that supports their position, so that judge feels that he is required to rule in their decision because the application of those facts to that law requires dad to have custody or dad to have joint physical custody or dad to have some corollary to that kind of parental arrangement predicated upon those facts and the laws that were presented. 99% of the time in any family law court I've gone to, the attorneys are not talking law at all. They don't, and the reason they're not talking about it is because they don't know it. Family law is an area where lazy attorneys, in my opinion, have learned that they can make a lot of easy money without being very knowledgeable, without being very intelligent, by simply advocating in a negative light and saying the things that they feel their male client wants them to say or their female client wants them to say to upset the image and mental and emotional wherewithal of their partner. That is a former partner, former mate. That should not be the role of that advocate. And that is not my role. My role is to be cool, calm, talk about the facts, and show what laws support those facts which are favorable to that court to rule on my client's behalf. That's how it's supposed to work.
Ivy, help.
How it works.
Understood. Help educate our listening audience. What are some of the laws, some of the case law, some of the Michigan law that supports a shared custody arrangement and or that certainly qualifies children to enjoy parenting time in real time, something more than the cookie cutter every other weekend and Wednesday nights for dinner for both parents?
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a couple of dominant statutes, state laws that support that position that were put in the books in the late 70s and early 80s. And, you know, we can talk about that for a minute. They're important. There used to be an organization, I think it's still out here, the organization's called Fathers for Equal Rights. Fathers for Equal Rights was started by a gentleman named Al Lebo.
Mm-hmm.
And when,
when
Al Lebo first got involved, he had the energy and he had the passion to really advocate for fathers' rights because he did not like the way he was treated. He was kind of like Murray was when he found Dads of Michigan. However, Al Lebo was political, and he was able to persuade the Michigan legislature after a series of years and meetings to initiate legislation to address the shared parenting issue. Now, there is one statute that's on the books that was that is a watered-down version of what the initial legislative intent was, intent of its design. In the late 70s, it was designed to be a shared parenting arrangement. That was the legislative intent. By the time it was watered down and became statute, it became a joint custody statute with very fuzzy language, but nevertheless mandatory legal language indicative of how judges were to conduct themselves when parties petitioned for shared custody. One of the most important statutes, in my opinion, is MCLA 722.26A. It's called joint custody. It is a Michigan statute. A Michigan statute means that it was created by the members of the legislature in Michigan to address the parenting issues of divorcing parents. There is very strong and specific language in MCLA 722.26A. For example, in the legal environment, the word, quote, shall, unquote, S-H-A-L-L, has legal significance. Shall means the court is required to adhere to the requirements of the statute. So any area of the statute or any sentence within the statute that incorporates the word shall means that this trial judge, irrespective of his bias, is required to do certain things. And this particular statute on joint custody has a lot of mandatory language in there indicative of how the court is to conduct itself when parties want shared parenting. Despite that, they don't. They don't because most attorneys don't use it. Most attorneys don't even know about it, tragically. And those who do don't know how to apply it. However, let's talk about a couple of sentences in the statute. The first sentence of MCL 722.26A states, and I want you to listen real close to this, in custody disputes between parents, the parents shall, hello?
Mm-hmm.
Shall, hello? Shall be advised of joint custody. Did you hear what I just said?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard a court advise the parents coming into the courtroom that they shall be advised of joint custody? No. They don't do it. They don't do it because the attorneys don't do it. The judge is only going to do what the attorneys instruct him to do. He's only going to consider what they ask him to consider. The second sentence, at the request of either parent, the court shall, hello? The court shall consider an award of joint custody and shall state on the record the reasons for granting or denying a request. Now, I've just quoted you the first two sentences of this statute, which is an extremely powerful statute. And yet, it's not being used.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it, I mean, obviously some attorneys don't know to, but what about those that do, Ivy? Why isn't it done more? And why... I know in 7 years, nobody's ever, a friend of the court or a judge or nobody, quite frankly, has ever advised me of joint custody.
Well, the attorneys don't because they don't know the law, and the judges don't because they don't know the law. Understand, most judges did not run for office to practice law.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most judges, I mean, whether they had a calling or not, They ran to be judged in order to be a judge. You know, their positions is that they judge based upon the merits and the arguments. So, and it's up to the attorneys to present the merits and the case law and the arguments before them, and then they make a determination predicated upon those advocacy skills. So if the attorney doesn't know about it and the judge doesn't know about it, guess where you're at?
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you something about my experience with this piece of the law. I know that you and I spoke off the record on this, Ivy, about the Child Custody Act of 1970. And I, by just sheer luck, going through my own personal case about 8 years ago, I believe it's because of my own advocacy roots, just knowing that I needed to be there for my kid, even though my specific and initial representation, my legal representation at the time, did not go over this statute with me. And that's not usually the practice, as you pointed out. But again, by sheer luck, because I actually petitioned the friend of the court, and I made it, I put it in writing on a number of occasions that I felt that shared custody was best for my child. And I didn't have a clue about the Child Custody Act. Had never read it, Ivy and Larry. But as it points out here in the Child Custody Act, it says, at the request of either party, the court shall consider an award of joint custody. Now, little did I know, and I looked at this, gosh, it was a couple of years later before I had realized what kind of success I had had and probably what that had hinged on. And so, yes, the law can be a very powerful tool, as you're pointing out, Ivy, if you know how to use it and you know how to interpret it, right?
Exactly, and that's what And that's exactly what you need to do, and you need to make sure that you have an advocate doing, that he knows the law. You don't make sure. Let me tell you, many of the attorneys who I retained assume that you want them to adopt your hatred for your spouse as
sure.
that you
sure.
have, or your dislike, or your anger, and that they're kind of like, what do you call it, mercenaries, I guess, for lack of a better
sure.
word, hired hitmen to make her life miserable. However, the reality is that this is not their role. And they should be making it very clear to you that you have a business arrangement. And they are not, a good attorney would say, I am not going to play that kind of stupid game with you to impress you, because if I do, you lose. You lose. Not only do you lose in the lower level, but if we appeal it to a higher level and they ascertain that this was the demeanor and style that I conducted myself while in the lower court, then in that higher court, you lose. Now, I have had some strong success in the courts of appeals when it comes to shared parenting rights and getting my clients custody, and I can give you names and numbers, most of which came from Dads of Michigan or Fathers for Equal Rights. But it was never, you know, those who try to insist that I conduct myself like a crazy, angry ex-husband or soon-to-be ex-husband, or who's really pissed off because his wife wants to leave him, or she's had an affair, or whatever it was, that was not my role. I didn't play it because he would lose. What I consistently looked for, however, that does not mean that I would not take those facts that worked, those being one of them, for example, one of the factors in the Child Custody Act, and use it to his benefit to show that she had not adhered, or she or he was lax relative to that particular factor, and to be able to show by a number of factual situations how applying the factors of the Child Custody Act, my client was leaps and bounds the stronger parent. Again, it's applying the facts to the law to support your case. And you haven't got to be an angry, violent, upset advocate to do that. As a matter of fact, if you are doing that, your client might feel good because you're upsetting a former spouse, but you're losing the war. And the
right.
objective should be to win the war. And that's how it's supposed to work. Now, understand, I want to address one other thing, too, real quick before we get back into the statute.
Sure.
Because, again, it's about the courts knowing. Many times you have got to bring the court on your page because the judge has been sitting on one page for the last 10, 15 years. Mom gets custody, dad gets the shaft, because this is the way it's supposed to work, you know. And no one has brought anything to him to believe differently or to conduct himself differently. So, again, it's about pulling out the facts that are existing not only within the lives of the parties, you know, the husband, wife, soon-to-be former husband, former wife, but that the effects on the children that could take place if this judge makes a bad ruling. And in many of my presentations relative to advocating for a good shared planning time for my client, I would simply talk about some of the facts that I had learned in my life as a teacher in various colleges and universities in the area of criminal justice or criminal law or just several areas that I've taught in. And I would provide that information to the court. For example, there is one statistic that always acquired a lot of great eyebrows and eyes rolling whenever I mentioned it. And here's one big statistic. And I want you to listen to this statistic. 89.5% of the felons in state and federal prisons come from divorced one-parent homes. Is that staggering or what?
Yep, and boy, well, have we heard these statistics before.
93% of those one-parent homes are headed by moms.
Mm-hmm.
Just those two statistics alone should persuade any court in this country to take shared parenting seriously. And yet,
Ivy, how about the statistics further that point out how suicide among adolescents are 5, sometimes 7 times higher among those kids
of
who are coming from single-parent homes.
Divorced one-parent homes. 90% of all homeless and runaway children come from divorced one-parent homes. 85% of all children that exhibit behavior disorders come from divorced one-parent homes. 71% of all high school dropouts come from divorced one-parent homes. Young women are 16 times more likely to suffer from depression or a bipolar disorder than a young woman from an intact family. I mean, I could go on and on and on.
Yep.
Most of these statistics come from the U.S. Bureau of Census.
Yep.
I've got, you know, the footnotes of where each one of these statistics come from. This is not something that's been made up, and most judges, when they hear it, are shaken.
Yep.
I mean, you have their attention. They're ready to listen. Again, it's coming to the courtroom with good facts and good law. If that's happening, then you've got better than a ghost of a chance of acquiring some shared parenting time with your child.
Ivy, I don't want to get off the case law and the legislation that's there, but just a quick question. Have you noted in the time now that you've been involved in this, that with that kind of information and more the courts and the legislation are being educated with that kind of information, have you noted any trends different than what it was, say, 10 years ago? Do you note that judges tend to be more receptive to a shared parenting arrangement than, say, what it was 10, 15 years ago?
No.
No, okay.
No, because not much has changed. I mean, you still don't have strong advocates, attorneys who are really advocating the way they should, and you don't have men who are uniting the way they need to be uniting and lobbying for the kind of changes that need to be made to make the system work better. Men are not like women. Women have an edge on us that way. Women are natural organizers. They lobby. They have a more united front than men. So until that happens, it's not going to happen. But as long as, you know, we have groups like Dads and Moms of Michigan who are continuing to make noise, you continue to, you know, get some attention, and hopefully, you know, we'll be able to figure this thing out. But it's going to take a lot more. You know, this is a political issue. These are political issues,
mm-hmm.
In order to get the kind of laws enacted and executed the way they should be, you've got to be political.
And, no question.
That's one of the, I'm hoping that's going to be one of the missions of Dads and Moms of Michigan, to accept the realities and to get more political, to, you know, to make these things happen. But, yeah, it's, we got a ways to go. So hopefully with the organization you guys are associated with, you can push to make some change, because if it doesn't happen, your kids are going to be going through the same crap.
That's exactly what drives, I think, most of the advocates is that, look, you know, Larry Herron, for example, talks about leaving a legacy all the time. What kind of a legacy am I going to leave for my kid? Well, you know what? Got to do something with our time, and trying to change a system that we have to live in, and hopefully a system, God knows, you know, you don't get married and have kids so that you can get divorced, and or, you know, when your children are getting married, you're not saying, you know what, son or daughter, I'm glad for this day, and I hope you have a couple, three kids, and then in 5 years you're getting divorced and you're going to go through this stuff, you know. I think that certainly what we hope for is that our children never have to go through this kind of a thing. But at the same time, if they ever do, we want to leave something better for our children. We want to leave something better for society in this type of a realm. And sure enough, what we also find in statistics is that the states where shared parenting is more the norm, that the early results, and it tends to be early because it's such a new phenomena, shared parenting in some of these states, but that the ones that do tend to have more of it as a norm, that how ironic, the early returns are that the divorce rates are going down. And, you know, I think anybody might have been able to conclude that, though. But, Ivy, tell us, what are some other case law or legislation that speaks to that it's in the best interest of kids, or that the courts should be providing more of a shared parenting arrangement?
Well, there are an array, a myriad of cases. I mean, maybe what I'll do for one of your next meetings is I'll have a number of precedents, cases.
Let me throw one at you and tell us what you're thinking of this, because I know more and more attorneys have used this, the Michigan Parenting Time Act, that I don't have it in front of me and I can't memorize it word for word, but it's basically the parenting time shall be divvied out in a quantity or frequency of time that supports a strong parent-child bond or relationship. Do you know the one I'm speaking to?
Sure.
And I've always been baffled at why that's not used more in a case.
99% of the time is because the attorneys have not brought it up to the court for the court's consideration. It's typically, I'm not, you know, if a judge does not do what you want him to do, and you've got good facts and good law, you take it up on appeal, you've got a good chance of getting that judge reversed.
Mm-hmm.
However, you've got to present it down in the lower court. And you have to make sure that that judge in the lower court is aware that you have no problem taking him up to a higher court, and you've got the financial wherewithal to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, you know, I have found that most of the time those statutes and cases are not being applied because the attorneys are not bringing them up and aggressively advocating for the application of them in that particular case. And, you know, it's really not necessary to do a lot of talking when you've got good law. You should kind of like milk the law. You should stay on it. You should stay on that ride as long as you can stay on that ride, because as long as you're addressing on the record those statutes that support your position, then the stronger your appellate case will look and feel to that panel of appellate judges once they receive it. So you just stay on it. You milk the law and you milk the facts associated with that law. And they're not doing it. And, you know, it's just necessary for them to do it. I think one thing that I am concerned about is when you waste too much time in a lower court going, it's clear that you're going nowhere, and yet you spend a lot of money and a lot of time in the lower court instead of putting together a strong case in the lower court that's supported by law and then going directly up to a higher court. That's, to me, that's the best use of money. But typically what happens, you've spent so much time and money on the lower level that by the time you're ready to appeal, all the money's gone. And you're tired and bitter and broke. So I think that it's good that if you can find the right practitioner, that the parties, you know, dad or mom, who is ever going through this mess, work out a strategy indicative of how this case is going to be conducted. And that should be done both with you and the attorney. Do not rely on the attorney to conduct that. You've got to be as well-read as you possibly can and have an idea indicative of how you want this case to move and flow. And then share that steering wheel. Don't leave it all up to him because, you know, again, what you're dealing with out here. So I think that being armed with the law and knowing you got some good facts that support it, then it's working with your practitioner or your advocate to make sure that you can follow it through as far as you need to follow it through to get the kind of result that you want to get.
Right, right. Ivy, just switching gears for a minute, what do you think about the tendencies that the court are using more to have litigants do more mediation and arbitration and parenting time coordinators? Do you think those are good moves?
Yeah, I do. I really do. In my opinion, these issues should not even be in a courtroom. I don't believe that any one person should be deciding what's in the best interest of your kids except the parents. And if one of the parents are being unreasonable, or if the court determines that a parent's being unreasonable, then the court should order some psychological evaluations in order to determine which parent psychologically is better fit. That's not hard to tell. So, you know, one of the niceties, though, about a fight for joint custody is that you can make those kinds of requests. And if psychologically father is stronger than mom, then that expert will come forward and talk about those areas. You know, and that is a big hammer towards persuading the other party to be reasonable and coming up with a fair shared parenting agreement.
Well, it certainly levels the playing field, doesn't it? And when you've got two parents who are otherwise fighting because you know, there's an effort to gain control, or somebody's already in it and now wanting to lose control, it tends to bring somebody in who can get a little bit more up close and personal with the case, know the case, and level that playing field when they can see that both parents are otherwise equally able to parent, just not so equally able to encourage the other parent's existence in that child's life. All of a sudden, that parent that may be trying to get the other one out of it is a little bit more compliant, a little bit more willing when they've got somebody who's watching for accountability. that's been my experience as a parenting time coordinator, as a parent coach, as a therapist, that you get somebody who all of a sudden is trying to impress you a little bit because they don't want you coming out against them, or they don't want to, you know, be seen as not being accountable. All of a sudden they're, you know, taking that hat off a little bit and holding it in their hand, and now you got some room to try and rework that dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I think an interesting dynamic, and you've kind of touched on it a little bit, Ivy, is that, you know, we've got professionals, you know, in your field, you know, in the field of law, and let's face it, when you're going into a courtroom scenario, they're called opening arguments and closing arguments, right?
Yeah.
Well, what I think is interesting is that, isn't it, when you're in a divorce or never married scenario and kids are in the mix and a custody issue, I mean, you know, the fur, a lot of times, the possibility of the fur flying is really high. But the fact of the matter is, isn't it disagreement, high disagreement and arguing that got these people where they are already, and facing off two professional viewers in a courtroom scenario, is that really justice for our families? Is that really is that an area where we should continue to go in that same tired paradigm, or should we be embracing new ways of conciliatory approaches, you know, that are going to keep, as you and Larry had dialogued on, are going to keep these folks out of the courtroom, and in most instances using, you know, experts and professionals in either mental health fields or otherwise, are hopefully going to bring these folks together, and hopefully they're going to have an attorney that's of the same mind as you, Ivy, that, you know, children need and benefit from the influence and the responsible upbringing of both parents.
I agree totally. Alternate methods of addressing this issue, other than being inside of a courtroom, is definitely the most preferred way to go. And I'm impressed that some courtrooms are embracing that. And, I hope it continues. It's not being done nearly enough. I think that as long as the attorneys representing the parties can have some control over their parties, because let's face it, divorce is a very emotional experience. I mean, the marriage was obviously not working, despite the desires of one or both of the parties for the marriage to work. Their lives are now beginning to go in a direction that they really don't have a clue as to how it's going to end. You know, they have some facsimile of a clue, but they really don't know how their life's going to be going once they're out of this marriage. So there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of intensity, a lot of emotionalism, and as long as the attorney can have some kind of control over his client, and the attorney has the educational wherewithal to advocate on behalf of his client, then you can get a much better result by alternative facilitation than you can in the courtroom, typically. So I am hoping, again, that continues, but it's not being done on a large enough scale for me to get really excited about it.
Well, and that's the thing, Ivy. I mean, if you can come to consent agreements, that's certainly a better use of the time and resources, on behalf of your clients. But at the same time, you don't have to bring your arguments to a judge who's really only going to see, you know, for the most part, just very small segments of the case, and they have to make a fully developed ruling, you know, based on who's going to put forth the best argument, you know, the most convincing scenario. You know, is that really where you want to put your family? But I'll tell you what, folks, we're coming up. I just came up on the hour, and so we're going to start winding things down. Well, let me ask you this, Ivy. What, you know, leaving our listeners tonight, what, you know, what else do you have in mind that you'd like to bring forth in tonight's episode?
Well, I think that we've covered quite a bit tonight. If I'm invited again in the future, I'll, again, my focus is going to be on law and facts and marrying the law and the facts so that they can have a better idea of how to pick an advocate and how to look out for themselves. There is one thing that I would like to talk about, and that's the hierarchy of Michigan law, real quick.
Sure.
There are three levels of law primarily in Michigan. The highest level of law in Michigan are really the Michigan court rules. I mean, the courts are bound to adhere to the Michigan court rules. And many of those court rules actually, in significant part of when adhered to, can support your case. Next to the Michigan court rules is the legislative laws, or the statutes, as they're called. And those statutes, for example, MCL 722.26A, a legislature got together, passed a bill, created a statute. That's got a lot of bite, a lot of power in a courtroom. That judge listens really, really close. And then the third level of law is Michigan case law, precedent law. Cases that have been decided by a higher court, whether it be the Michigan Court of Appeals or the Michigan Supreme Court. And those cases that have been decided on a particular issue serve as a precedent for how other cases with similar facts are supposed to be resolved. So, if your attorney knows how to apply the statutes with the facts and he's got some good case law that of cases that are corollary to the facts that your client has in his particular marriage or former marriage and or his particular relationship with his children, then, again, he or she is in a better situation to get a more favorable, fair result. So just knowing how those hierarchy of the laws work is should work as a guide for how you initiate your own research in advocating for your case or being a supportive advocate in your case. Meaning that you first want to go, you know, outside of the court rules, you want to go to those statutes on custody and find out what are those statutes and how do the facts in your case compare with those statutes. And then you want to check out some case law. How do those cases with facts similar to yours, how were they resolved? And which one of those cases can you use to assist your attorney? You need to do that kind of review. You got to be, just like you have to be involved in your medical care, you got to be involved in the legal experiences, especially when they come down to legal affairs dealing with family and children. You cannot simply give it to an attorney and a judge to figure out. So by understanding and addressing and doing the research predicated upon those different levels of the law, you can arm yourself to look out better for you and your children.
Very good.
Thanks,
I'll tell you what. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, I was just gonna say it makes sense. Absolutely, you don't want to just leave yourself hanging out there and dependent on somebody who, again, as Ivy's pointing out, you've hired because you're assuming they know. They might not. And if they don't, you don't necessarily have to understand why something doesn't look right. You don't necessarily have to understand how to do it. Obviously, if you understood how to do it, you wouldn't be hiring somebody to do it for you. But you know what, Dave? You're the builder. I don't know anything about putting up a wall, but I know what one is supposed to look like. If it's going up crooked, I'm going to say, hey, let me give my buddy Taylor over here and tell me how this is supposed to look. I don't know how to do it, but I know
it
doesn't
look right.
Yeah,
we got these things down in Indiana we call levels and plumbs.
There you go. There
you
go. And we need to make sure there's a level put on somebody that we're hiring for our children, because when the stakes are that high, when it comes down to you hiring somebody to ensure that your parentage is maintained in real time, and that your time with your children supports a quality of parenting, a quality of that it authenticates a parental role, that it's not a cookie cutter every other weekend kind of visitation status, you better know that you got the right person. You better know what that looks like. So, Ivy, so much appreciate you coming on, so much appreciate the knowledge that you're sharing with our listening audience. You brought a great deal of value to our program. We appreciate it. And Dave, I think it's safe to assume, isn't it, that we'll definitely invite Ivy back again. We'd be thrilled to have him.
Well, if he'll have us, sure.
Absolutely, gentlemen. It's been fun. Looking forward to the next time.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we'll talk offline, Ivy. You know, about the future program, and I would imagine that's going to entail a lot more case law and. You know, higher court law, and it'll be an interesting, you know, just like this show, it'll be highly interesting and informative to our listeners. And, you know, we sincerely appreciate the opportunity to have you on the show, Ivy, and it was a great pleasure getting to finally, you know, meet you in person, and then having you agree to come on Best Interest of the Family Radio was an absolute delight. So we appreciate your time tonight.
Fantastic, guys. Thanks a lot.
All right,
we'll
talk to you soon, Ivy.
Take care.
You too. Well, I'll tell you what, Larry, while there was some dialogue going on with Ivy tonight, I was looking up, you know, I'd already pulled up the Child Custody Act, and I know that pretty well anyway. I don't, you know, not verbatim, but I know aspects of it and mm-hmm. how to speak to it. But there was something that you brought up, and that was the Parenting Time Act or the
right.
Parenting Time Guidelines. Now, this is how it reads, and you do a pretty good job of recollection of that. Let me read it, though. Michigan statutes recognize that when parenting time or parenting, when parents separate or divorce, their children's best interests are served by continuation of parent-child relationship. So strong is this relationship that law establishes a presumption that it is in the best interest of children to have a strong relationship with both parents. Therefore, parenting time should be in a frequency, duration, and type reasonably calculated to promote a strong relationship between the children and the parent. The children have a right to parenting time. And I think that's interesting the way that's written. The children have a right to parenting time unless the court determines on the record by clear and convincing evidence that parenting time would endanger the children's physical or mental or emotional health, which is MCL 722-27A.
There you go.
And what's interesting about that, and you said here tonight, don't we have enough laws in the books to get shared parenting time? Well, or shared custody? Yeah, we do. But as our guest tonight, Ivy Sheldon, attorney, pointed out, the problem is in many instances, we're not getting the proper representation or the legal mouthpiece that's needed to go into these situations and literally legally advocate for your continued existence and legacy, as you put it, in the life of your children.
Right. That is so true. And there again, there's some powerful language that truly I've had more and more family law attorneys tell me that has teeth. That has a lot of teeth in it, in the language that's being used in that case law. Judges do tend to listen to it, and of course, it's up for debate. It's always a matter of perception of what frequency that parenting time should be in each individual case. But Dave, it doesn't take a trained clinician to understand that to promote a strong parent-child bond, it's going to take something more than every other weekend. As many family law attorneys have told me, they've never, even at friend of the court, have never had anybody answer them that an every other weekend visitation is enough to do it. That, you know, when they're really backed into a corner and asked to explain how that little bit of frequency in time supports or authenticates a parental role to maintain a strong parent-child relationship, show me some hardcore facts that back that up versus some that, again, Ivy brought up tonight and that we see so many times in statistics. They can't do it. They don't even try most. And, you know, it's just ludicrous to me that with that sort of language and research that's out there today, and quite frankly, Dave, anybody who wants to exhibit just a little bit of common sense, it's ludicrous to me how anybody can say when a parent is otherwise willing and able to step up and be healthy in their children's lives, why anybody would challenge that, would frustrate that effort.
Right, right. And I think that's, you used an interesting word, authenticate. You know, authenticate a parental role. You know, why are we having to authenticate anything? Why are we having to argue, as Ivy Shelton pointed out, why are we having to defend, for pity's sake, what is the right of every child and every parent? And that is to love and cherish and encourage each other through life. It's like I always say, don't ask permission to be your child's parent. It's a given. It's already there. Just parent your kids.
Yep.
You know, and if you have to get involved with advocacy groups, new tongue again, just breaking it in tonight, folks, tripping over it. But I'm obviously so passionate about these issues. Sometimes that occurs, but certainly get involved on a stronger and higher advocacy level, because these issues are not going to change overnight. And these issues are certainly not going to, change the hearts and minds of those that are not educated in these areas. And we need more mouthpieces out there understanding what the root issues are. Number one root issue is children need both parents. I'm not just saying that, folks. You know, I'll let Larry Heron, the parent coach, speak to that issue.
Well, Dave, you already have, and quite honestly, there's not really much that needs to be said in that regard, because it has been, and anybody understands that who understands parenting. I mean, let's be honest, let's be real. Kids need both parents. Kids need a whole and complete relationship with each one of their parents. This isn't 1935 when. And you know what? I wasn't around in 1935, so I'm not so sure what that was about.
Well, there were more intact families in 1935.
Right. There was definitely more intact families, no question. But you know, the realm that dad goes out and works his tail off because it's all about keeping a roof over your head and the biggest house wins and whoever has the most toys and send the kids off to college. But you know what? I've had a few of those 1935, 1940 people in my office, Dave, who are crying like infants because they didn't get the time with their father that they needed, and that was an intact family. And they're walking around today, 70 years later, feeling like there's still this void. There's still this this missing affirmation. You know, we had Ken Mazur on a few shows ago talking about the albatross that hangs around a man's neck, never feeling affirmed by their dad, never feeling good enough because they just didn't experience the time needed with that father to experience it. And I think we've learned something since those days that, in fact, men, dads do need to be hands-on parents, do need to be equally involved in parenting their children, that we nurture differently, but we nurture just the same, that a father's nurturing that a mother's nurturing, they're equally important, and that both parents staying involved in all the elements of parenting that kids need is what's in the best interest of kids. That's the way children thrive most, thrive in school, in social relationships, in work relationships, and in work efforts and setting goals and moving on and setting higher standards for themselves to achieve, and in life, quite frankly, in every measurable aspect of life, kids tend to fare better when both their parents have maintained a healthy existence in parenting them. So, you know, the research is out there. You can check over the last 10 to 15 years, all of the research. I mean, it just stands out significantly that it overwhelmingly concludes what we're saying here. But, you know, Dave, what's always impressed me or fascinated me, I should say, about research is how 99% of it concludes what common sense dictates.
Sure.
It's just amazing to me that we need a bunch of fancy research to conclude what common sense already dictates.
It always sounds better coming from someone. It always sounds better coming from someone that, you know, like yourself, you know, that has the experience and the, you know, you've got the hours and hours and hours and years of time, you know, with people, you know, sitting on your couch, you know, and you know, in addition to the educational background necessary to you know, provide these folks you know, the necessary therapy that they need, you know, but yeah, it should all come down, as far as parenting, it should come down to common sense, shouldn't it, Larry?
It really does. It absolutely does. And it's you know, prayerfully one day it'll all prevail.
Well, and it will. I'm convinced of that, Larry. I'm convinced, you know, because of the evidence in the strides that we've put forth in the, you know, in the years that you and I have been involved. I mean, you can see the evidence that we're turning individuals' thoughts as it pertains to shared parenting or the continued relationship between parents and children. You know, these are, you know, there's judges and there's FOC workers that, you know, that are coming to a better understanding, and they know that, you know, the paradigm for the longest time was, what was it called? The mad dads. Oh, the dads are mad because of whatever reason, but it's the mad dads. No, you know what? It's about parenting. It's about respect. It's about, you know, deciding that there really isn't anything to fight about. This is just, again, it comes back down to common sense. What makes the most sense? What is truly in the best interest of the children? And ultimately, what's in the best interest of the family?
No question about it.
That should be a radio program or something.
You know, yeah, it has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? I think we maybe could run with that a little bit, Dave.
Think? Well, let's do that. Let's run with that, and let's close down shop tonight. Been certainly a pleasure, Larry, and you know, happy Thanksgiving, and you know, many blessings to your home, and I'm certainly going to enjoy you know, the company on Thanksgiving, because I've been invited to the Herons, and I'm going to bring my famous deviled eggs along.
They won't last long, guaranteed.
Well, my friend, you know, we'll see you. We'll see you on Thanksgiving, and to all of our listeners, we will be back on the air again next Tuesday. And until then, God bless and happy Thanksgiving.
Good night.